talk about motor neuron disease, but I'd actually like to talk a little bit more about something else that's very important to everyone, and that's trying to sort out wheat from chaff in modern medicine, trying to work out evaluating different things that we consider as therapies or things to help us. And we're going to talk particularly with the relevance to motor neuron disease. I've been trying to find the person who said this originally, but it's something that was first said to me by my classics master at high school. He was an enigma, Charlie Fraser, and he would often come out with these little aphorisms that stick with you, even though you think that they won't at the time. But he'd come out with something in class, and he'd look at you just out from a tangent, and he'd say, "Son, minds are like parachutes. They only work if they're open." Many other ones, too. The end of that story, or off on a tangent, is that at the end of high school, I had to drop Latin and Greek because I was doing too much. And he said to me, I went up and said to him, "Father, you know, I have to stop Latin and Greek because I'm carrying too many units and I'm going to do physics and chemistry, so I'm going to hang on to them." And he looked at me and he said, "Son, if you'd like to look at your own snot in a test tube, go ahead." I apologise if anyone's heard that little story before. Fact. According to the OED, that which is of the nature of a fact, what had actually happened, is the case, truth attested by direct observation or authentic testimony.
Reality.
Fallacy.
A delusive notion.
An error, especially one founded on false reasoning. The condition of being deceived, deception, guile, trickery, trick, a false statement, a lie, sophism. Sounds like an election campaign. So what do we know about motor neuron disease? Well, increasingly we know a lot. How much do we need to know? Well, we need to know a hell of a lot more. From Charcot's original description, so he described the phenomenology of amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, the original form of motor neuron disease, we understand a lot more about the cause and why the disease gets worse. But we don't know enough yet to control or to cure it. We do know the distinctive pathology of motor neuron disease. And James is going to talk a little bit more about the information that you've heard before at this forum, together with new information about the importance of different subcellular mechanisms and pathological tags in motor neuron disease that enable us to understand the biology. In Sydney, we're very lucky in that there is a Using Our Brains scientific program that's run by Roger Pamphlet at Sydney University, together with other pathologists like Jill Krill and Glenda Halliday. This is a really important program because it's only by understanding the careful science and pathology behind motor neuron disease that we're going to make big leaps forward in this disease. So if you aren't aware of the Using Our Brains program, there's some pamphlets up the back. There we go. Thanks. It is a really, really important thing to at least discuss and think about. Because whilst the pathology may seem to be straightforward, again, it's not. So what is motor neuron disease? Well, it means different things to different people. Amyotrophic lateral sclerosis is sometimes used synonymously, but I think of motor neuron disease as an umbrella term, of which there are many, many different forms of disease, and we label them differently. And the labels are important because the nosology and the phenomenology ends up telling us whether these are the same diseases or distinct diseases. So again, it comes back to the concept of lumping versus splitting. So motor neuron disease is a part of the broad category of disorders of the anterior horn cell motor nuclei of the brainstem, and only some motor nuclei. So it doesn't affect the motor nuclei that control your eye movements. Why? Why are they spared? cortical motor neurons and corticospinal tracts. And depending on the balance of whether it's upper or lower motor neuron, and again, James is going to touch on this too, I think. So, depends on the balance. This balance determines the presentation. So if you have pure lower motor neuron dysfunction, your symptoms are weakness, cramp, twitching, incoordination, and fatigue. The sign, so when the neurologist gets out his tendon hammer and starts going umba and pulling his beard, what they're looking for is weakness, atrophy, fasciculations or little twitching in the muscle, reduced or absent reflexes, and floppy lips, hypotonia. And you hear people talk about upper motor neurons. So upper motor neurons sit up in your cortex and they talk to the motor neurons in your brainstem and spinal cord. And when these neurons are disturbed, that produces different symptoms and signs. So the symptoms are more stiffness, slowness, incoordination and clumsiness, and weakness. And the weakness is a specific or distinct pattern of weakness called pyramidal weakness. The signs, when the doctor examines the person, upper motor neuron signs are spasticity, which is, again, increased tone in the limbs, brisk reflexes, so your limbs jump when they tap with a tendon hammer, extensor plantar responses, so when someone tickles your toe goes up instead of down, and again, this distinct pattern of weakness, this pyramidal weakness. When you look in a textbook of neurology about the diseases that mimic motor neuron disease, the list is about 100 conditions long. And they range from the uncommon, which is amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, progressive bulbar palsy, muscular atrophy or flail limb syndromes, to toxin-related, so rocking horse manure-type conditions like, you know, lathyrism. So if you eat too many fava beans, you can end up with a similar disease to motor neuron disease. And then other disorders that are important to recognise, like multifocal motor neuropathy, that can look like motor neuron disease but are distinct pathologically. If we talk about amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, this is an uncommon disease. So the incidence is 2 to 3 per 100,000. Everyone who reads a website says mean survival of 30 months from diagnosis, and now a mean is an average survival of all comers. And there are patients that I look after who are 22 years out, 24 years out, 20 years out, 16 years out. So mean does not mean that's what's going to happen for any one given person. It also means on the other end that sometimes I look after people who live no longer than 6 months after their diagnosis, or even 6 weeks. It occurs more commonly in men than women for reasons that we don't understand, apart from bulbar onset of motor neuron disease, which is more common in women than men. In our clinic, our data, our youngest patient is 26 that we've managed, our oldest patient is 90, so it occurs at any age. There are probably 1,200 to 1,400 patients in Australia with motor neuron disease, although we've never had a community-based study to determine the exact incidence or prevalence of motor neuron disease in Australia. It's more than 500, it's 600 people a year die from motor neuron disease, and in the last decade it's gone from just under 500 to just under 600 for reasons we don't understand. Whether that's case ascertainment, so we're getting better at diagnosing it, or whether it's recognition of motor neuron disease in people that you wouldn't have even looked at, or whether it's the fact that it is more common. Unfortunately, my gut feeling is that it's the last. James also is going to touch on this a little bit, so there might be a little bit of duplication. So when we look at classic ALS, when you have combination upper and lower motor neuron features, that's the commonest form of motor neuron disease. If we have bulbar onset with upper and lower motor neuron features, and this is our second most common subset, there is a very small group of patients who have this progressive bulbar palsy, and James has done some beautiful research work looking at these patients using this cortical hyperexcitability test to try and work out, because progressive bulbar palsy patients tend to have a much, much longer survival than bulbar onset of amyotrophic lateral sclerosis. Patients with classic ALS can begin with just upper motor neuron features and then acquire their lower motor neuron features. There's a very rare condition called primary lateral sclerosis where patients survive on average 10 to 12 years from diagnosis, and that's just purely upper motor neuron. This group up here with a lower motor onset and progressive muscular atrophy, again the nosology has changed a little bit, and we tend to think of this progressive muscular atrophy as more flail limb onset, either leg or arm. Why is this important? Why is this splitting important? Could they be different diseases? Yes, they could be. However, when we look at the pathology, and the importance of pathology tells us that when you look at the spinal cord and brainstem of people who've died, whether they start down here, or up here, or over here, when you look at their brain and spinal cord, the pathology is pretty much the same, with a few exceptions. So is that just because we're looking at the end stage, that there are many different causes feeding down into the same pathway? And that's what I suspect that it's telling us. Is it inherited? Well, it's again, my concept is that it's seed and soil. So there are some forms of motor neuron disease where there is a single gene abnormality that leads to motor neuron disease. As we understand more about those diseases, and there have been two critical discoveries that the teams in Sydney contributed to, and the people who are here today collecting blood, and Garth Nicholson out at ANZACS, discovered two new genes over the last 18 months in motor neuron disease. A gene called TDP43 or TARDP, and James will touch on that, and another gene called FUS. Now, these, while they may not be a total answer to what's going on in motor neuron disease, they are incredibly important steps into understanding the biology. So, of the 10% of patients who have this autosomal dominant inheritance, so parent passes it on to child, onto grandchild, 10% of patients can have that history when they have motor neuron disease. In Sydney, it's 18% of the patients have a mutation in this SOD1 gene, of which there are more than 100 abnormalities in various parts of the gene. And it's very curious because there's even debate at the moment as to whether some of those genetic abnormalities are even contributory into motor neuron disease, whether they're innocent bystanders or not. And it's a curious gene too, because it's not just one bit of the gene that has a mutation. They can be in parts of the gene that are active and talk, or parts of the gene that are silent, which is pretty uncommon in genetics. In the literature, they argue that this concept called genotype confers phenotype. Now, what does that mean? Well, in the States, that where the literature has been dominated, if you have a specific genetic abnormality, then that gene abnormality determines the age of onset and where your disease begins. So that's what's written in the textbooks. But our experience in Australia is that that's not true at all. In fact, we look after families where a particular mutation, V148K in SOD1, can start at 19, or in the 70s, and it can begin with swallowing, or it can begin with foot drop, and some patients are stable for a decade and other patients are very unwell very quickly. So this genotype equals phenotype concept is not true. It might be true for a certain number of gene abnormalities, but we don't think that it holds up. And then you have to ask, well, where does it all begin? Who had the first SOD1 mutation? Where is the founder effect? Can you have a gene abnormality that arises spontaneously? Can it come out of the blue? Yes, it can. There is one case report where they've looked at both parents, and there is the old axiom that paternity is only presumed, but where they have actually looked at special techniques to determine that the parents are the parents. There is someone who died with motor neuron disease who had a new SOD1 gene abnormality. So there is a founder effect with SOD1. And other genes, as we've talked about, TDP43 and FUS, have followed over the last year. So how do we diagnose motor neuron disease? Again, we're dealing with fact, but there's still some chaff rather than wheat about the diagnosis of motor neuron disease. So we don't yet have a single blood test. We don't yet have a single scan, MRI scan. We don't yet have a single nerve test or nerve study. And again, James will talk a little bit about the exciting work that he's done with Matthew Kiernan and Steve Bucic out of Neuro. Now, it's called Neuroscience Research Australia instead of Palmary. And many people would have been out to see them. So we have to find, when we diagnose neurophysiologically, we have to find evidence of lower motor neuron degeneration, evidence of upper motor neuron degeneration by clinical examination, progressive spread, and there are criteria which are trying to be revised because the Ellis-Gorrill criteria actually tend to be a little bit too rigorous. We have diseases that are mistaken for motor neuron disease, and whilst these are uncommon, it's important when you hear the sound of hoofbeats that you don't just think of horses every time. You've got to think of zebras. Because if you don't think about things that can look like motor neuron disease, you miss it. And particularly this one is really important. Because most of the time, this condition, if left untreated, behaves and looks exactly like motor neuron disease. And James has actually put together all the cases from Sydney, but we still haven't got it up yet? No. Okay. We're trying to get it published to show that they talk about this concept called conduction block, and conduction block isn't a requirement for the diagnosis of multifocal motor neuropathy. It's nice if you've got it, but you don't have to have it. Whenever you see a slide that has a long list or complicated diagrams, it means that there's a lot of theory and a lot of hand-waving, but not a lot of fact. So there are facts that look at the complex interaction between environment and genes that are involved in triggering motor neuron disease. There are certain occupations where motor neuron disease is more common. So it's more common in professional athletes, in Serie A football players in Italy. Is that because people with a predisposition to motor neuron disease were likely to be better athletes? Or is it because exercise leads in some way to contributing to motor neuron disease? Or was there some other agent that was involved in producing motor neuron disease? So again, many questions. The genetics are very important. So understanding predisposition as well as the single monogenic or single gene causes of motor neuron disease. A theory that's been around for a long time is this glutamate excitotoxicity. So glutamate is an amino acid that all of us have in every cell, in every fluid in our body. Without it, you don't live. Your brain doesn't work. We add it to our food in MSG. But there is a theory that too much glutamate is harmful to nerves, that nerves don't like too much glutamate. And Riluzole, one of the medicines that we use in motor neuron disease, perhaps reduces the effect of glutamate so that cells can be a little bit more robust to it. So in many models, they found that in motor neuron disease, you have excess glutamate in the spinal fluid, and that by blocking this glutamate, that might be helpful. It doesn't mean that you need to go off and have a no MSG diet, because the dietary glutamate that you eat, which is in everything that you eat, doesn't get into your brain. Oxidative stress. So there's too much oxidation going on. And again, when you look at post-mortem material, there is evidence of damage, oxidative damage in the nervous system. However, that is tissue that is injured. So oxidative stress is a very common mechanism to arthritis, to hardening of the arteries, to atherosclerosis, to many, many different conditions. So there's nothing unique about oxidative stress in motor neuron disease. Abnormal calcium homeostasis. So I talked before about how your eye movements are left untouched pretty much in motor neuron disease. Well, the special motor neurons that govern your eyes, when you look at the special binding proteins for calcium, you don't have those binding proteins in those special motor neurons that govern your eyes. But you do have these binding proteins in other cell populations. So what's the story there? Calcium homeostasis may well be critical abnormal mitochondrial function and abnormal trafficking of protein and also RNA. We spend a lot of time trying to look at the different forms of motor neuron disease because that's actually one of our best abilities to guide prognosis. So there are forms of motor neuron disease. And again, the colours haven't projected so well. And this is work done by Paul Talman and Susan Mathers, looking at different ways of categorising motor neuron disease. So the red here are upper motor neuron features. The purple here is lower motor neuron features. This is combined ALS. This is pure lower motor and this is pure upper motor neuron. And you can actually split up patients and divide them via their physical features as to what form of motor neuron disease they have. So the flail limb variant of motor neuron disease, you have severe wasting and weakness that's asymmetrical in the arms and chest. And this is important because, and this is Australian data, this is from the Australian Motor Neuron Disease Registry, of which many of you participate. So this is an observational cross-sectional registry where we look at people's survival with different forms of motor neuron disease. And I talked before about primary lateral sclerosis. So this is primary lateral sclerosis with survival in years. This is ALS, bulbar onset, and again the colours don't project too well, I'm sorry. So this is the worst survival. So bulbar onset, on average, tends to be a more difficult form of motor neuron disease to look after, principally because it attacks the most important things for survival, your swallowing and your breathing first. Increasingly, we have more sophisticated ways of measuring the progression of motor neuron disease because at the moment we do not have a biological marker. We do not have a surrogate marker of the rate of progression of motor neuron disease. And Matthew and James and Rob Henderson up in Queensland and Steve Vujic are very clever in their methods of looking at transcranial magnetic stimulation and axonal excitability, Rob Henderson with Muni. There are various different scales that we use, and the commonest or most widely used scale is this scale called the ALS-FRS-R, which is generally accepted. It's easy to do, but it's not very sensitive. If you have an ALS-FRS score of 40 out of 48 and someone else has a score of 40 out of 48, they can be very different in their capacity to do things, so it doesn't necessarily translate into the disability the person has. It's unfortunately the best tool that, well, the most widely spread tool. It's not the best tool available. We've been very interested in non-invasive ventilation and the early use of non-invasive ventilation because we know that we can double people's survival if they're symptomatic with nocturnal hypoventilation. So we survey for it very frequently and we try and work out whether it's a central cause of hypoventilation or if it's another problem like obstructive sleep apnea where people snore too much. And there are various different measures of pulmonary function, but they're all relatively insensitive. The best one is actually asking the patient, seeing if they're having trouble lying down when they sleep. Do they have to lie on their side or are they comfortable lying on their back? And then overnight oximetry with a little machine to measure the oxygen concentration in your blood. We've also been very interested in magnetic resonance imaging, and in work that we've done, we can actually, in combination with transcranial magnetic stimulation, map the rate of progression of motor neuron disease. It's a fairly expensive method, and we've yet to reproduce that. We can measure the rate of change. That's research that we will get up and running again now that we've moved out to Macquarie. So what else do we don't know? What else is fact? Well, we do know the fact is that riluzole does improve survival. It improves survival if you start it earlier, there are some data to suggest that at very high dose it might be more effective than the usual one tablet twice a day. But whether the adverse effects are worth the benefit is questionable. But there are two large randomized controlled trials that show that riluzole improves survival in motor neurone disease. There are a few side effects. It's not without its problems. Looking after people well, multidisciplinary care, or interdisciplinary care with physio, speech, dietitian, speech pathology, occupational therapist, good integrated care nearly doubles survival. So just doing simple things better doubles survival. And that's not unique in medicine, that's very common, that if you do little things and simple things well, then not only are the patients better, they do much better. So Brian Trainer published in 2003, he looked at patients who were managed in Dublin at their specialist motor neurone disease clinic versus patients who were managed in the rest of Ireland in the general neurology clinic. And these were the patients who were managed in the motor neurone disease clinic, and these were the patients, their survival curve, managed in general neurology clinic. And it's even more potent when you have to consider interventions like with bulbar motor neurone disease, early PEG, and good non-invasive respiratory support. The survival effect is even more profound. So non-invasive ventilation, again, is proven. So it's proven to improve survival. So why isn't it supported by the state? Why isn't it supported by the HRC? In Queensland, the government supports, the Department of Health supports NIB. In Victoria, the state health department pays for NIB. What's wrong in New South Wales? No, don't answer the question. But why not? So we need to do some lobbying here. Why do we have to pay for these leases for these NIV machines, or to pay for them outright, when it dramatically improves survival in randomised controlled trial? So, to fallacies. We've talked about fact. And while there are lots of fact there, and I've put a couple of people to sleep, I see. Sorry. One of the hardest bits of my job is trying to work out wheat from chaff. And I know this is called Ask the Expert session, but I think that I stand up here under false pretenses, because I don't think there's such a thing as an expert. I should have defined expert, shouldn't I? We all learn about this disease every day, and we have to learn more about this disease. But I'm asked every Wednesday when I run MND clinic at Macquarie, people say, well, what about X or Y or Z? What about wool of bat or eye of newt? Why can't we do this? How do you respond to that? Do I sit there in judgment and say, no, that sounds stupid? Or do I say, well, let's evaluate the evidence and try and work out and make a decision between us as to whether we pursue something or not? And I try to give everyone the four question test. And if you remember anything from what I've been saying, I want you to take away this, the four question test. So when anyone proposes a therapy, you have to ask, what is the premise or fact behind the proposed therapy? It doesn't have to be a proof, because proofs are pretty thin on the ground. So what's the premise? Does it seem logical? How is the therapy exactly going to help you? Is it going to help your symptoms? Is it going to slow the rate of progression of disease? Is it going to control it? How exactly is it going to help you? So that's the second question. The third question that you have to ask is, how might the therapy hurt you? And there are three forms of hurt here.
The first is physical hurt, so unintended effects, diarrhea, nausea, whatever. The second is psychological, when you've been sold some snake oil and it doesn't work, then the rug is pulled out. And that's a psychological adverse consequence. And the third adverse consequence, how it might hurt you, is financial. Because there are charlatans, crooks and thieves out there that are willing to put their hand up. And I can give you many, many examples of that that occur here in Sydney. Lastly, the last question you have to ask is, what has the person got to gain? So think about their gain. And if it seems like they're gaining inordinately or excessively for what they're offering you, then run. So those four questions are really important. And if you get green lights rather than red lights to all those four questions, then it might be worthwhile pursuing. So let's apply that to vitamin E. Let's apply the four question test to vitamin E. Innocuous. Buy it at the health food store. Can't hurt me. Has to help me. So what's the premise? How could vitamin E help motor neurone disease? Well, there is evidence for oxidative stress in motor neurone disease, pathologically, biochemically, and vitamin E is an antioxidant. Sure. Holds water. There is a little bit of weak data from epidemiology that vitamin E might help to prevent motor neurone disease, but the studies are really very poor. There's no reported case of motor neurone disease due to taking too much vitamin E, so you can't catch MND from taking vitamin E. And when you give vitamin E to mice, that nasty scientists have given motor neurone disease, they actually have a slightly improved survival. So it sort of holds water. There are a couple of studies looking at survival in motor neurone disease with normal doses, 1,000 international units a day, and it doesn't help fight motor neurone disease. And megadoses in trial do not help motor neurone disease. There are some method problems with the trials, and they didn't actually do the splitting out like we do here to look at the different subtypes of motor neurone disease. So this could be a false negative, but the trial data suggests that we shouldn't take vitamin E. Could vitamin E hurt us? Could we be getting sick from taking vitamin E? Well, in the only trials in motor neurone disease, probably not. But in cardiovascular disease, you die sooner with vitamin E than if you don't take it. And that is pretty solid data. Who's going to gain from vitamin E? It's $30 for 100 capsules, $150 a year, at two a day. $4 billion industry, the vitamin industry in Australia. Is that money well spent? Blackmores don't make any vitamin supplements here in Australia. They're all made in China, packaged and sold. So is that worth it? I don't know. I'm going to finish there. That's 40. 34. Whack-a-doo. Fantastic. More time for questions. I told you I'd come in early. So I've thrown a lot at you. We do have fact in motor neurone disease, and I've given you a broad overview that James is hopefully going to flesh out a bit more in the latest research in the field. But hopefully I've given you a tool, because everyone who's under the gun says, well, there has to be something there. And I don't have the answer. I certainly am willing, and I have to help you dissect out what's fact from what might be fallacy. It's a very, very tricky field. So I sent Roger a copy of an email, so I yanked the chain of my old boss from Houston, who's the head of ALS TDI Research Committee, because Roger had squeezed my nuts, so I yanked his chain. It was sort of knock-on effect. And Stan replied, you know, we don't have anything that's ready to go yet. There are promising therapies, and one of the things that I'm really concerned about in the trials that are done thus far is that most North American and European trials only split it out between ALS and bulbar. So they're not correcting for the flail limb elements, which to me is crucial. If you have uneven groups with two-thirds in one group flail and the one-third classic ALS, and the other group is one-third flail and two-thirds classic ALS, you might lose a treatment effect. Or you might say that this treatment makes someone worse, but it's really the natural history of the condition. So we need better ways to measure. Now, I do have one question from George about exercise. Do you want me to answer that one? Okay. So George asked me, is there any proven benefit for exercise in motor neurone disease? Is that the question? Excellent. So, there is no data to suggest... I talked about Serie A footballers being more likely to get motor neurone disease. There's also a cluster of American, North American footballers from San Francisco that developed motor neurone disease all at about the same time. I think that it's unlikely that sport causes motor neurone disease for any individual person. You'd then have to, if it was a contributory factor, you'd have to ask, well, what are the genetic influences that made it more of a problem for one person and not the other? And I think that's more important than the exercise itself. Once you have motor neurone disease, is exercise important? Yes, I think it is for many things. It's important for mood, it's important for mobility, it's important for pain management. Can we prove that exercise improves survival in motor neurone disease? No, not yet. There are various small little trials, but there are, again, too many variables to actually sift out whether it is or not. I think for the individual, exercise is important. Never exercise to fatigue. Never exercise to exhaustion. Paul, you've got a question.
My question is on pathogenesis. And again, this first one is a bit jocular. Talking about athletes, it's John Colbert and John Pollard, most Hollywood. He comes to the conclusion every person needs everything they do is a very nice person. So I said, for matter of sure, we're not a hustler or a lie. So maybe being nice is also a condition, a true condition.
Are you sort of saying that I'm not going to get it?
No.
Is that right? You're having a dig.
The pathogenesis, is the last research conference I went to, they mentioned that the one paper suggested that maybe it's in glia that it might hold the triggering key was distinct from the motor neuron itself.
Yeah, I think actually I'm all of my research work in Parkinson's disease was focusing on glia, and I think glia. So the question was are the glia important in motor neurone disease? Are the supporting cells to neurons? And there's 10 to 20 glia for every neuron in your brain and spinal cord. And motor neurons are big cells, and they have a cast of many, many glia that support them and nourish them and make sure that their surrounding environment is important. So three broad sorts of glia. There's astrocytes, which are very important supportive cells. There's oligodendrocytes, which produce myelin that insulate the cells and their axons. And then there's really important cells called microglia, which are sort of like the sentinel, the immune alarm bells in your central nervous system. And I mentioned Stan Appel before. Stan has been banging on about the importance of glia and the immune system in motor neurone disease for probably 20 years. And a lot of his work is now coming out to be shown to be correct. So the glia are critical, and I think... even in SOD motor neuron disease. It appears that the glia are very important in how motor neuron disease spreads like a fire in the coal seam through your nervous system, that they are involved in transmitting perhaps the process from one nerve cell to another. So I think the glia are the key. Spot on. Roger's got a question. Yep, excellent. So toxicity, both exogenous toxins from your environment and endogenous toxins, because everyone wants a cause. So endogenous toxins, glutamate is perhaps an example of that. And exogenous toxins, there might be a few clues from epidemiology. So some people have studied occupation and occupational exposures as a risk to motor neuron disease. And it is shown in large epidemiologic studies and repeated that if you fly for a living, so cabin crew or pilot or engineer, you are statistically more likely to get motor neuron disease. So what's the element there that does that? Is it repeated exposures to depressurization to 10,000 feet? Well, probably not. Is it radiation exposure? Probably not. What is it? We don't know. And you can turn the question around, why do 999,999 people who do fly for a living don't get motor neuron disease? Why is it the one in 100,000 or two per 100,000? But the observation is really quite robust, as is the observation that if you are involved in the petrochemical industry in some form, you're a little bit more likely to get motor neuron disease. I don't think it's smoking guns. And I think that there are multiple potential triggers to this pathway that damages motor neurons. And, and I don't think that we're going to be able to necessarily circumvent those exposures. They may, however, be really important keys to the biology of motor neuron disease. Stunned into silence. Come on. Graham's got a question right in front of me. There's one just here, and then I'll take you, Graham.
I don't know how the Morrisons start, is there any method, whatever, for monitoring what Prilosec does?
Excellent question. Because when you're the frog in the water, it's hard to tell what the temperature is. It doesn't make you stronger. All you notice is cumulative weakness, and in fact it feels like the weakness is accelerating. So that's a result of the fact that by the time that any particular muscle is weak or you have any noticeable symptoms, 70% of the nerve cells talking to that muscle are already gone. 70%. So if you chart the cell loss, the disease starts, the cells die, you've lost 70%, then the symptoms start. And then you go to the GP, and if it's slurring of speech, you get sent to an ear, nose and throat specialist, and then you go back to the GP, and then you finally go and see someone who diagnoses motor neuron disease. I don't know why GPs send dysarthria to ear, nose and throat surgeons. So down here, now if we graph our disability at the same time, so it's zero, now, Rilatec changes that a little bit. So it's like trying to stop a semi-trailer by putting your foot on the ground. It helps a little bit. So, I think how to measure that? How do we measure Rilatec? Well, we know Rilatec gets into the brain. We know it gets into the spinal fluid. We know it actually reduces the effect of glutamate for which it was originally designed and promoted. and the glutamate effect, there may be other effects that it's important. We do know in repeated observations post-1994 that people who take Rilatec earlier do better or betterer. The government, when they first produced the subsidy, refused to give it to people over 80 because they weren't included in the trial data. They were excluded from the trial. And we fought a long campaign against... Who was it? Abbott? Is it Abbott who refused... The one before Abbott, was it? I don't know. And finally, it's not age restricted. So, how do we measure it? We don't have a measure. It's from large observations that it does have an effect. But when you're the one taking it, you say, "Well, what is this doing for me? I'm getting weaker."
Have you made any observations for whether it's better to for the patient to take Rilatec before breakfast or before meals or after?
The data from the company suggests that it should be taken on an empty stomach, that it does get higher levels in your blood, and then it's got a better likelihood of having an effect in the brain. In reality, sometimes on an empty stomach can make you feel nauseated and reduce your appetite so that you don't really want to eat that much. Sometimes people get diarrhea too on an empty stomach. More important than Rilatec, I think, is nutrition and keeping your weight up, which is why every time someone comes to see me, they have to step on the scales, and if they've lost too much weight, I get cranky. So the drug company says in their handout you should take it on an empty stomach before meals, about 12 hours apart.
In relation to the dosage, you said that in my husband's case, he takes 2 a day. Who and when decides whether you will up the dosage or...
Yeah. So the question was about Rilatec dose. Why is it just one a day, 50 milligrams twice a day? Well, the trials from Paris and from Northern Europe did show a trend that 2 tablets twice a day might be a little bit better, but it wasn't statistically significant, and the trials have not been repeated further. I think it depends on side effects, weighing up side effects, and also how big the person is. So if you're a 48-kilo, 70-year-old woman, then 2 tablets twice a day, you're not going to tolerate. If you're a 130-kilo, 25-year-old man, you'll easily tolerate 2 twice a day. So it's something to discuss with your neurologist, whether you want to trial it.
And in relation to possibly that question of the use of Rilatec, in the manual they say that you should avoid caffeine or alcohol to drink it. My husband says...
Absolutely. So I strongly encourage alcohol. And with the one proviso, it has to be good alcohol. Okay? And define good. Well, it's hard to define good. But it has to be alcohol. I mean, a glass of wine or 2 glasses of wine at night or whatever.
It won't do anything. Like,
no.
Say, statins in taking grapefruit juice or something like that.
No.
Yeah.
Graham had a question.
Just on toxins, there was recently something in the on the American ALS website about tobacco ALS being a toxin. Is there any evidence to suggest that?
I don't know that data. I'll have to look at it, but not that I'm aware of from last time I looked at the epidemiology, but if there is something new, that'll be very interesting. I mean, the interesting thing about tobacco is that there's probably 100,000 different toxins in one drag, so how they're going to sort out the wheat from the chaff in that, it's going to be hard to answer. Yes, Paul.
I think I know the answer, but I think I ask it. Does the body have the capacity to regenerate neurons, particularly motor neurons in the motor cortex? I know there are some parts of the brain where it does happen, I understand.
Yeah.
But, and I understand that generally that's when the answer that they can't do it. But is that because we haven't gone far enough in the research, or...
No, yep, so can nerve cells repair themselves broadly. There is a limited capacity of nerve cells, depending on what part of the nerve cell is injured, to take up the slack. And a lot of that, the balance between nerve degeneration and nerve's ability to repair, contributes to the rate of progression of your symptoms. So if you've got a big firestorm going through your nervous system and you've got a garden hose with 500 litres on your back, then you're not going to be able to fight the fire that well. If you've got not such a big fire that's not moving that rapidly and you've got 1,000 tankers full of water, then you can perhaps slow down the advancement of the bushfire. So we can, and often in neurophysiology that James and Matthew and Steve do, they can measure the ability of the nerve cells to compensate. So there is a limited capacity for the nervous system to compensate. It's actually breathtaking at how good it is. But eventually those systems fail. And to come to the crux of what you're asking, can we make new motor neurons in your cortex or in your spinal cord? No, not at present. But even if we could inject new motor neurons into the cortex or into the spinal cord, to make a motor neuron send an axon out to a weak muscle, which in some people is a meter and some people it's a little bit less, so to send an axon all the way out to the muscle in my foot is very hard. If the nerve cell was the size of a tennis ball sitting in Birmingham, the end of the axon would be in Berlin. So it's a huge distance. So the biology, I think the crux to motor neuron disease is actually, rather than trying to stop a semi-trailer with our foot, we get some bloody good disc brakes. So we've got to understand what's making it move forward. There was a question over here. Yes, ma'am. So the question was, can a neurologist tell you how advanced it is and how long you've got to survive? No. No. I defy anyone. And I end up having to pick up a lot of pieces. So one of my younger... G'day. Got five? Going to give me five? Yay! Well done.
Oh, I don't want this.
He doesn't know where I've been. One of my patients, who's not here today, last year, was told by the referring neurologist that he had bulbar onset motor neuron disease. He should give up his job, sell his home, that he'll probably be dead by Christmas. This was in January. And the first couple of months of me looking after him was actually trying to put him back together to say that that's not the case. No one has a crystal ball. Now, there are some general recommendations that, or observations. So if you have respiratory involvement at the beginning, so if you're breathless when you lie down flat, if you get short of breath overnight, a lot sleeping on your back, then that makes us think of nocturnal hyperventilation requirements. So if you're symptomatic and we don't treat nocturnal hyperventilation, then it's a bad problem. It feeds forward on itself, and we know that patients with motor neuron disease don't do very well if we don't ventilate them, which is sort of quite surprising. In my practice, 40% of patients have nocturnal ventilation, but the general percentage in Australia is around about 10%. I don't know why. And also swallowing. So swallowing, if that's early involvement, then that can lead to problems with nutrition and hydration. It's not the swallowing or speech itself that's the problem, it's the consequence of it. So if you don't do anything about... And there's a dissociation there. Speech can be severely affected, but swallowing isn't, or vice versa. You can have patients with severe problems with swallowing and their speech is relatively unaffected. So you have to be careful and think about what the most important problem is, and if nutrition and hydration are issues, then fix it with simple physical remedies. But there are plenty of patients with bulbar onset motor neurone disease who are very well many years down the track. So I would defy anyone to be able to say, you've got this long. Why then do doctors do that? Why do they do it? Yes, well, on that point, on respiratory infections, often with motor neurone disease, you don't put temperatures up. So if you think your breathing has changed, often it's a good idea just to start antibiotics empirically. Now, if your GP doesn't want to do it, then make sure your neurologist gives you a script and you have some medicine that's just sitting there waiting. And sure, you might be treating some infections that aren't bacterial, but it's better to do it sooner rather than later. Because often you don't put up a temperature, often you don't cough or you don't bring up sputum until it's a good going form of pneumonia, which we don't want. So yes, coming back to why doctors do it, I haven't got a clue and I wish they'd stop. Because it's often that psychological dimension I find is much more potent in that person's perception of quality of life. And I think that if they would just say, listen, I don't know, then that's at least... So what's in it for them to say, you've only got 2 years? I don't know.
Has it been reported properly? That's the question. Because most patients probably ask how long they've got to go. And our experience has been the other way, that the doctors say, well, they've got no clue.
Excellent. Perfect. Then that's great. If they say that, then that's good. Because, none of us knows what tomorrow brings. Not one person in this room knows what tomorrow brings. So we live with this veneer that we understand that we're going to be, we know what's going to happen next week or next month or next year. But it's nothing more than a veneer.
But that's where the frustration is, you know, when you're observing and you're seeing whether the real attack is working. What's the next step? What's the next development? What's the next form of deterioration? Frustration for both the person who's suffering.
As well as their family, yeah. I hear you.
No, this question about this nocturnal
hypoventilation, yeah.
You say that you have to lie on your back. Is it necessary to lie on your back?
No. I think maybe I didn't express myself clearly. So often nocturnal hypoventilation becomes symptomatic when people lie on their back without pillows. So when they're lying on their back, then they might feel like they're just not getting quite enough air and they have to lie on their side or sit up on pillows to sleep better through the night. So that's an early warning sign that nocturnal hypoventilation might be an evolution. So it's not, you don't have to sleep on your back.
But to have the BPAP machine,
no.
You have to lie on your back.
No.
Because I use a CPAP.
Yes.
And I find that I can't do it on the side. I have to be on my back. In the morning,
Yes. Yeah. So, no, you don't have to sleep on your back. Excellent. That's what I feel like doing, too.
Just one or two more questions, so if you can.
Yes.
How do you know when the
Carolyn asked, how do you know when we've progressed from CPAP to BiPAP? CPAP therapy is not usually used in motor neurone disease. So CPAP stands for continuous positive airway pressure. So it produces a gentle mask that keeps your throat open when you go into REM sleep. So you don't go... You don't snore. Now BiPAP is different. BiPAP delivers two levels of ventilatory support. So it delivers an inspiratory pressure, so when it listens to when you take your breath, it's got a little trigger mechanism, and you breathe in and it pushes air in. You hear people say, what are your settings? What's your IPAP setting? Is it 10 or 12 or 14 or 16 or 11? So that's IPAP, and there's centimetres of water, and it delivers. It keeps your airway open, and then the EPAP is when you breathe out against it, and it keeps your airway open so that it doesn't block off. So BiPAP is by far the most common form of therapy, and that's what the respiratory doctors are expert in, working out whether you need CPAP or BiPAP. I was wondering when you were going to surface.
Is there any therapeutic measure on the way with
Again, Phil, just once more, are there any improvements on Riluzole? There are several trials that are going on in France with different therapies. There's an anti-no-go therapy. There's another therapy that's looking at a chemical called VEGF. There's another agent that is a cholesterol derivative that is looking promising in many different models. But the problem for us is that the mouse model, the SOD1 mouse model, is not a valid model for sporadic human disease. And I find that really frustrating, that everyone has to prove that it works in mice before we try it in humans. Nearly every drug that they say has a survival benefit in mice does not work in humans. Doesn't. So minocycline, CoQ10, creatine, wool of bat, eye of newt, yada, yada, yada. Goes on and on and on. And so even when they show a 10% survival benefit in mice, it doesn't work in humans. And then the other thing that really annoys me is this lack of acknowledgement of the different clinical phenotypes that by themselves determine different biological outcomes. And if you do not correct for the five different forms of motor neuron disease, when you're testing a drug in motor neuron disease, you will make error. If they're not adequate, and you're talking about a rare disease to begin with, so how do you get the numbers enough? Well, it's only by pooling resources. And increasingly, you know, we're getting better and better at communicating with our mates in the Northern Hemisphere, and Americans are a little bit more parochial. They tend to like doing things themselves because they think that only they understand things. There are a few exceptions to that.
Okay, let's questions
I unfortunately can't stay. I've just down the road we've got a whole heap of equipment that has arrived and I have to go and supervise that. So I'd please, if you would accept my apologies, I have to make an exit stage right. Again, if you have any follow-up questions, if you want to send them to Gina or on to me at dominicrowe@mac.com, I will get round to them, I promise.
On behalf of everybody, I'd really like to thank Dominic for his time this morning. It's just, I guess, not many times you get the opportunity to just ask questions and have someone like Dom to present the information and know that it's coming from someone who is an expert, as much as an expert can be an expert. So thank you very much, Dom, for giving us your time this morning. We've just got a small token of our...